Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As the Iranian people lay to rest their supreme leader, Donald Trump has again returned to making deadly threats. These threats make a mockery of the Memorandum of Understanding framework aimed at ending the war. This is still more evidence the West is agreement incapable. Crosstalking the lack of diplomacy, I'm joined by my guest, Haytham Faraj in Beirut. He is a trial lawyer and a retired Marine Corps officer. In Berlin, we have Kavurk Amasyan. He is founder of Syriana Analysis. And in London, we cross to Mohammed Akunji. He is a criminal law and human rights lawyer. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's first go to Beirut. Haytham, where are we? 4 months in here. We had this thing called the Memorandum of Understanding. Most people are referring to it as the Memorandum of Misunderstanding. Embedded in that agreement, which is an agreement to start talks, to start negotiations, is the proviso that neither side makes threats against the other. Well, Trump broke that immediately after it was signed, and he continues to do that. We have had an exchange of kinetic action. We still have, if I can put it mildly, misunderstandings about the Strait of Hormuz. Where are we right now? Are we already at some kind of dead end? Go ahead, in Beirut.
Thank you for having me, Peter. I think this was the intent from the outset. The U.S. was looking for a way out. It was in a pickle. And I anticipated from the outset that the nuclear talks would never engage. We would never get to nuclear talks. But it was dead on arrival. I'm in Beirut. The drones have never stopped overhead. I was in the south 2 days ago. The destruction is vast and continuing. Yesterday, a school director or principal was murdered in the town of Nabatiya, along with her mother, her domestic helper, and a Syrian man. She was in an area that was not under occupation. She went to visit her home, which was not under occupation. And she's just a civilian, and the Israelis killed her without justification. That's a violation of the first paragraph of the Memorandum of Understanding, which is a cessation of all hostilities on all fronts. And so the Israelis have never been interested in a ceasefire. They can't live with a ceasefire, more specifically Netanyahu, because that's what his political career was built on. And Trump was looking for a quick exit, as they say in the in American lexicon, sort of punting the ball forward and then dealing with it at some other time in the future.
Yeah, but it isn't it resolving any of the core issues. Actually, you know, what we are seeing here is mediation by third parties without any kind of negotiation. Putting it bluntly, when Trump says he wants a deal, we all know what he wants. He wants Iran to surrender. That's the problem. Go ahead.
Actually, if Trump wants for Iran to surrender, and since he alleged before coming president that he will end the forever wars, I think the Iranians will give him the forever talks. And this will be the last deal that he would reach with the Iranians until the end of his presidency in 2 years from now. And as we may also know that the midterm elections are ahead of us, and I believe that Donald Trump nowadays, the options are very limited in his hands. He cannot truly escalate against Iran, and at the same time, he cannot withdraw from this deal. So there will be a stalemate in the region. No talks, no deals, and no wars. However, we have to be very careful with another factor, and that is Israel. As our respected guest mentioned in Lebanon, if we see what the defense minister of Israel said, only recently, this was on Monday, he said that Israel has no territorial claims over Lebanon, but will not withdraw a millimeter from Lebanon. So they are redefining what occupation means, basically, in Lebanon. And this is an attempt to sabotage the deal itself, the memorandum of understanding, because Lebanon was part of the deal and it is mentioned on paper and there is a signature on it. However, Israel cannot live with, not only with a, not, without a ceasefire, they cannot really sustain their operations in the region because their intentions is expansionism. They want to expand into the Litani River. And how would they do that if there is no conflict and if there is no war inside Lebanon itself? So in my opinion, Israel thrives on war in the region, and the Zionist ideology that is basically governing the Israeli government nowadays, and I mean, for decades, right? I think in this case, we will definitely see Netanyahu trying to push all his domestic problems, also that he's facing lots of trials in his own country, into Lebanon, but also in Syria. In Syria on Tuesday, there has been several blasts in Damascus. While Macron was present there, only 150 meters away from where he resided in the hotel. So one of the theories is that Israel is very upset at the Western opening to Jolani and trying to bring him back to the international community. Then Jolani himself trying to present himself as a Western-oriented, of course, figure. So there could be two theories. One is Israel trying to destabilize Damascus again. And the other theory is that the former jihadists or the takfiris inside the regime of Jolani are trying also to sabotage any attempt for Jolani to open up to the West. So this is a very complicated situation.
Yeah,
but all in all, I don't see exit.
Yeah, but Kavod, we keep being told over and over again that Donald Trump is the boss. He has to remind us over and over again he's the boss for some reason, which obviously means...
You don't have to remind anyone you're the boss if you are the boss.
That
doesn't work that way. Even in the jungle, the alpha doesn't tell anyone that he's the alpha.
Well, you know, just watch the Game of Thrones, okay? Mohammed, let me go to you. I mean, what Trump, when we all talk about an off-ramp, what Trump wanted, I think everybody agrees that was the case. He was willing to sign anything to stop the kinetic action. And importantly, what he wanted most, which he has not gotten yet, is the opening of the Strait of Hormuz. And that is the dilemma. The strategic petroleum reserve is draining, gentlemen, very, very quickly. He has a dilemma that he cannot resolve. Mohammed.
That's true. I think the one thing that we can be certain about with respect to Trump is whatever words he uses in the English language are almost certainly not going to be according to reality or his own will. So a lot of the words he uses are simply there to placate or to mitigate the markets when it comes to prices of oil. But the hard wall of whether oil will actually exist to even talk about in the United States is coming up fairly quickly. So the difficulty with Iran and how it's orientated towards the US is there's no such thing as diplomacy with the US under Trump. This is not diplomacy. This is simply words being used for political or domestic political reasons rather than actually solving any problem. And the idea that Trump is the boss is completely undermined by the fact that the Israelis were looking to murder, once again, the Iranian negotiators, and the CIA had to go and tell the Pakistanis that this was the case, not do anything about it themselves, not put a warning shot across the bows of Israel. They were so mealy-mouthed and timid when it comes to Israel that they rat on, like in a playground, the intent to the Pakistanis, who aren't known to be a superpower at all, but actually solved the problem. So where the United States security apparatus is less cogent or less effective than the Pakistani security apparatus, then sort of really is the reduction in the or a clarification in terms of the power dynamic in the region vis-a-vis the United States.
Well, exactly. Haytham, you know, we have this kind of dynamic duo of the Secretary of State and the Vice President. They seem to have very different agendas in the same administration. I mean, obviously, as it's already been pointed out, is that Israel is allowed a veto.
Yeah, I have to distinguish between the professional intelligence framework within the United States and those appointed political appointees from my personal experience, and I spent 22 years in the military, we did not have cooperation with the Israelis. We never trusted them. We didn't trust them in with intelligence information. We didn't trust them when it came to operational planning. Where there is trust is when it's paid for. AIPAC comes in, it buys politicians that swear allegiance to the United States with, you know, their fingers crossed behind their back because it's really for the Israelis. And so what Mohammed touched on is important, that, you know, CIA went to the Pakistanis. It's not because that the CIA is mealy-mouthed. The professionals have no problem telling the Israelis, but the Israelis aren't going to move based on what the CIA tells them. Now, with respect to Rubio and J.D. Vance, look, it reflects their internal politics. J.D. Vance really is more focused on, tends to be more focused on what's in the interest of the United States, and Marco Rubio is bought and paid for. I mean, this is how I explain, and I'm sure your guests know, this is how you can explain many things in U.S. politics. Who has paid to get that politician into office? The independent ones that are being funded by grassroots campaign funding, they have independent decision-making. They usually make their decisions based on the interests of their constituents and what's in the interest of the United States. And then you have the ones that are bought and paid for by AIPAC. It's legalized corruption that we tend to criticize all over the world while it goes on under our in our backyards.
Well, Haytham, as we go to the break, the good thing is the silver lining of all this is that people in the United States are beginning to become aware of it, and it is impacting elections, which we'll talk about in the second half of the program. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the lack of diplomacy. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the lack of diplomacy. Okay, let's go back to Berlin. Kavok, you know, one thing is, for let's talk about what can't happen. We can't go back to the status quo ante. That's never going to happen. The present status quo is not tenable, and I think we're all in agreement for a variety of reasons. So where do we go from here? Because one thing we can all be sure of, Iran is not going back into the box. Okay, it has liberated itself. It is no longer under suffering the siege policies that the United States has directed against it for almost 50 years. It's not going to go back. It's not going to, and it wants to keep its winnings. How is that going to happen? Kavar, go ahead in Berlin.
Actually, this memorandum of understanding, as also J.D. Vance said, it will give an opportunity for the United States to refill the stocks. And the Iranians also listening to the American officials, and I believe that they are getting ready for a different type of warfare in the near future. I think the Americans have exhausted their military, let's say, options inside Iran. Therefore, the ceiling, if the ceiling has been a war, now we have a lot of other tools under the factor of or the element of war, and those are, some of them are cyber attacks, others are financial means. We have also psychological operations. We will see, of course, a lot of pressure on Iran will continue through the neoconservative and also Zionist, whether those are NGOs or organizations or political forces inside the United States. There will be concerted attempts by the Zionists to sabotage this deal, and they are very powerful inside the United States. They are so powerful that they can dictate foreign policy on the United States. In this particular case, the Americans have gone with the Israelis in this war of aggressions, and they were happy in the first phase and the second phase of assassinations. They participated in the planning and the execution of the officials inside Iran. But once the assassinations turn out to be counterproductive for the interests of the United States, and that means that the Iranian IRGC has started to gain more momentum and more control over the state policy of Iran, mm-hmm. The Americans warned the Pakistanis of the third phase of the assassinations, because this has proven to be counterproductive for them. But the Americans were participants of these assassinations since the beginning. So in my opinion, anything that comes under the war, the Americans will continue participating with the Israelis, but the Israeli lobby inside the United States will try to push the limits through Lebanon. This is the first thing that we will see, that they will put in enormous pressure there so that the Iranians would retaliate again militarily, and that would create new conditions in the region or no new incentives for war from the Israeli side. I don't see that there is a win-win situation here. The Arabic Gulf countries probably trying to convince the Americans that they could bring the Iranians to a negotiation table or try to minimize the animosity between the Iranians and the Americans, but this animosity will not evaporate between the Iranians and the Israelis. And this is a major, this is the number one reason why there has been a war between the Americans and...
Yeah, but also it wants to deny the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic, because if you have good faith negotiations, you recognize them as a legitimate interlocutor, and that the Israelis abhor that. They do not want Iran to be treated as a quote-unquote normal country. Mohammed, let me go to you. I mean, we can look at American elections here in the AIPAC and the Zionist lobby in general, their control over foreign policy. But there's a lot of cracks. You know, a couple weeks ago when it happened in New York, you know, I'd say, okay, that's New York. New York is New York. It's like I live in Moscow. Moscow is not Russia. Okay, they're very different. You can't make the comparison across the board. But then it happened in Colorado. Then it happened in Washington D.C. It's happening a lot right now. A woman in Colorado challenged a woman that had 30 years in Congress, and she was this woman, I don't want to be mistaken here, either from Ethiopia or Ethiopian descent. She was a lawyer. She was fired from her job for speaking out about the Palestinians. She ran against this congresswoman and destroyed her electorally. And why? It was because of Palestine. I never in my life would have thought, and I want Haytham to talk about this too, that this would be so front and center for so many people in American politics. It truly is astounding. Go ahead in London.
So I think if I were to put myself 10 to 20 years in the future, I don't think any of us would be talking about Israel except for in history books, given the way the demographic is, the younger demographic are viewing what Israel is. Now, for me, we're literally talking about a country that is in terminal decline. Its support base, even amongst its own sort of perceived community, the Jewish community in the United States, is falling away amongst the young. Its behavior has caused the entire globe to look into not just what it's doing now, but the religious underpinnings that are professed by its leaders for why they behave the way they do. There's this notion of it's not just apartheid, but a form of religious superiority that gives genetic superiority, which is a lesson that every young person in the West has been taught about for three generations when it came to the Nazis, that this is evil, so much so that another regime fell, which was South Africa. Now, when individuals are comparing the behavior and the reasoning espoused by the leadership and the population on social media of Israel, it is indistinguishable from what we were taught about the rhetoric of the Second World War, indistinguishable. And so it's normal for the population who have been educated about this to completely reject it, because we were taught to reject it in the schools. So I think it's not surprising that this is happening. As our other guest from the United States explained, that the only reason that really that Israel has any purchase and strong purchase in the United States is through corruption and bribery, legalized bribery. Now, how long that can last as a tool of force when the entire population is now being made aware of it and rebelling against it, well, you can't bribe the entire general public to vote for your candidate. In fact, now AIPAC is now the mark of Cain. There are many elected representatives who are now rejecting AIPAC money.
Yep.
Because they realize that it will stand against them when it comes to electoral cogency. So when politicians reject money, you know it's bad.
Haytham, you weigh in on that because you're a veteran of the American military and you know the politics of the what the West calls the Greater Middle East, or we should call West Asia. What's your reaction to this? Because a few years ago, this would have been unheard of. Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, what Mohammed is talking about is spot on right. I think the transformation that we are all experiencing is a direct result of the decline of the traditional media control over the narrative. Social media is a double-edged sword, but the fact of the matter is, Gaza revealed what the Zionist state of mind is, what the Zionist interests are, and that it doesn't appeal to anyone. It doesn't appeal to anyone in the West that I know. But there's another piece, you know, in addition to the violations of human rights and the genocide and the deliberate starvation of children, the attack on hospitals under the guise of being command and control centers or places of worship, Americans are discovering that regardless of who they vote for, the person is usually placed there by AIPAC, and they've been awakened. They realize now that if AIPAC touches something, it is that politician, whether Democrat or Republican, is not going to be working with their interests first, but the interests of the state of Israel. And so just like I think anywhere in the world, people are when they realize that someone is working against their interests, they're going to respond. And I think that's what we're seeing. So on the one hand, you have the Palestine-Gaza issue and the violence perpetrated by the Zionist state. And then on the other hand, control of the American political system. And both have resulted in a rejection by the wider American public, and especially the younger generations. I mean, the 50s are under, in poll after poll, and the most recent one I think was in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, poll after poll, Americans are rejecting Israel and AIPAC or Zionism. And so what Mohammed said is probably not too far away from the truth. In 20 years, I don't know that we will have an Israel as we know it today.
Okay.
And this is not exclusive, by the way, to the United States. Also in Europe, for example, they are sanctioning nowadays journalists inside Europe via the European Union without any court decision for their reporting on Gaza. So people are losing their bank accounts. They are losing their health insurances. They are losing their ability to buy food for their children. For example, Hussein Doğru, who lives in Berlin, for reporting about Gaza. So this is not exclusive to the United States. They are terrorizing journalists and outlets all around the world for speaking up for the Palestinians in this case or criticizing Israel. So this shows that there is a political panic among the corridors of the politicians, watching that the alternative media and citizen journalists are basically weighing in and also replacing the mainstream press.
Well, Kvorka, let me stay with you here. I mean, we saw the UK again cracking down on, for example, people that will be, in Germany, sharing RT videos, irrespective of what the content is. I mean, Kvorka, I mean, it's the collapse of the Enlightenment. We're watching it in real time. The values that the West claims to colonize the world and to bestow upon lesser beings is just being gutted, and we're watching it in our own eyes right now. Kvorka, 30 seconds.
And Peter, I come from a position of someone who studied European affairs in Sciences Po. I studied the European Union. I was fascinated by the ideals of the European Union. And nowadays, we see that they are basically pursuing the opposite ideals and the values that they have preached in the past decades in the entire European Union, not only in Germany. But in Germany, particularly, there is a high sensitivity for criticizing Israel and Zionism. And I think this is embedded in the political class, that the political class is very paranoid about criticizing Israel, and people are nowadays whispering instead of talking, which tells you everything you need to know about the democratic conditions here.
But leaders like that, they're paranoid. You know why? Because they're weak and they're deceitful and they have no moral fiber. That's why they're paranoid, because everyone can see what they're doing now. And that status quo is untenable as well. Gentlemen, fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in London, Berlin, and in Beirut. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.